These Days.
Kids These Days.
This is Kids These Days.
More and more kids these days are being diagnosed with autism spectrum disorders, and many of us have questions and concerns about that. So today, we're talking about autism and what we know about it, and learning about the resources we have across Alaska to help families in need. We'll also take you to a Haynes kindergarten classroom to find out how one mom and a whole community are helping increase autism awareness there. Plus, find out about the special healing power that animals can have for some with ASD. That and more this hour on Kids These Days. Kids These Days is a once weekly conversation about issues in our communities that affect the lives of us all, especially our families. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and I'm your host. April, among other things, is Autism Awareness Month. We want to know what your experiences are with autism. Let us know by commenting right now on our website, that's kidstheseDays.org, or go to our Facebook page. Join us for an ongoing online conversation that starts now and continues there throughout the week. Well, with me today to talk about autism and resources in Alaska are Chris Green. Chris works for the state of Alaska as the Autism and Parent Service Manager and Rural Pediatric Neurodevelopmental Outreach and Autism Screening Clinic Manager. Through the Division of Public Health, she oversees autism program services and coordinates statewide screening clinics, which are held in 10 rural Alaska hub locations. Chris is a member of the Autism Ad Hoc Committee for the Governor's Council, which focuses on implementing the state of Alaska's autism plan. The goal is to improve access to care for Alaska children and youth with autism and their families. Thanks, Chris, for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Teresa Hurst is also here. She's a certified advanced practice pediatric nurse practitioner and a pediatric mental health specialist. She specializes in treating children with neurodevelopmental conditions. She works with the Children's Hospital at Providence, and she travels to regional hub communities to conduct assessments. She routinely provides patient, family, and staff education on pediatric neurodevelopmental disorders in communities and at conferences throughout Alaska. Thanks to you for being with us today, Teresa.
Thank you.
Well, ladies, I think a great place to begin this important conversation is to talk about autism spectrum disorder and to sort of get some of the basic facts out there. What is autism spectrum disorder? What does it look like? And you know, what do we need to know about it?
Autism spectrum disorder is a complex developmental condition that results from a neurological difference in the way that the brain is processing information. It includes autism, pervasive developmental disorder, as well as Asperger's. Autism spectrum disorder covers a wide range of symptoms that can range from mild to more severe and affects the child's ability to socialize, to communicate, as well as some differences in the way that they behave.
So there are three general kinds, isn't that right? Autistic disorder, Asperger syndrome, and then atypical autism, which you also said was pervasive developmental disorder, and those two are the same, is that correct?
It is the same.
Okay.
These are defined by what is called a diagnostic manual, mm-hmm. and that is put out by psychologists
teams of people who right. are looking at different developmental and mental
right. So
conditions.
They've defined these three different categories, and we've now started to talk about them in terms of this spectrum of autism. And so at one spectrum is the children that are what we consider classic autism, which are children that have significant communication impairments, significant problems with personal relationships, and some very atypical behaviors. The Asperger syndrome also have some of those same similar problems, but they don't have that communication delay. They have differences in the way they communicate, but their language is not delayed early on. And then pervasive developmental disorder captures those children that may start on the autism spectrum, but look more like their Asperger syndrome peers at some point as they are getting services. And so
So it might define a child or a young person whose symptoms are changing, so they're not necessarily in one category or the other. Is that what you're saying?
It may be used for that, but it also may capture those kids that have some of the characteristics but not all. So we often refer to those children as having an atypical form of autism. I think it's a misunderstanding to say a milder form. I think they still have some of the similar challenges that the other two groups have as well. I know that there's going to be some changes in the way that this is talked about in the future, because there's some changes that are happening in that diagnostic manual in the future.
Well, I'm glad that you bring that up, because we actually have a piece prepared exactly to that point. The rates of autism are on the rise. A recent report released by the Centers for Disease Control put the prevalence rate at 1 in 88 children. That's up from 1 in 110 in 2006 and 1 in 150 in 2002. Some say better screening or public education is responsible for the increase, while others say that it's simply better record keeping. Dr. Shubhu Ghosh is an Alaskan child psychiatrist who is currently helping to redefine the criteria used to diagnose autism. We asked him to help us understand why this increase is occurring and what to expect when the new diagnostic criteria are released in 2013. He spoke recently with Kids These Days producer Sarah Gonzalez.
Dr. Shubhu Ghosh, thank you so much for joining us again on Kids These Days.
Oh, thanks for having me.
First, I want to ask you about this report that the CDC released last month. They found quite a rapid increase in the rates of autism that's being diagnosed. They cite a number 1 in 88 children among the 14 states where they did their study, which is a huge rise from the 1 in 150 that they estimated in 2000. Can you sort of provide some insight on those numbers? What does that mean?
Sure. So the CDC did release a new report stating the prevalence rates. So I just want to educate everybody really quickly on prevalence rates. Prevalence refers to the actual number of autistic patients in the city, which is a ratio that you can calculate by dividing all autistic patients with the total population of your city. So on the other hand, incidence rate, the incidence refers to the new cases of autism in a single year that has surfaced in your city. So obviously the incidence rate is kind of the ratio that we want to focus on, the new cases. But the CDC definitely released a poignant ratio, because what it showed was that we definitely indeed have an increase in the problem. Since 2002, the problems have increased by 78%.
Why are those numbers going up so dramatically?
I feel like more accurate diagnosis is being done. There's all kinds of hypotheses out there in terms of what the causes are. But what we do know is that our diagnostic ability and technology is getting better. So with that, we can really see a pattern in children and a social and communication pattern.
Okay. You're talking about the diagnostics, and that's something that you've been involved with, Dr. Ghosh, as part of the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual, the fifth edition. You're contributing to help redefine those diagnostic criteria for autism. Is that correct?
Yes, I am.
And so what does your work look like? How might those criteria be changing once that manual, the fifth edition, is released?
Right. Currently, we have a bunch of syndromes and not one clear-cut opinion on what autism should look like. So in the new manual, we're going to have a thing called autism spectrum disorder and a social communication disorder. So the person that doesn't meet the criteria of autism spectrum disorder will be in that social communication.
And that's a brand new diagnosis?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And so with the autism diagnosis, the way it stands now, we believe in like a 3-2-1-1 system, which is like social and communication problems before age 3. And we have two abnormalities in a social interaction criteria, which, can range from, not appropriately having age-appropriate friends to actually having difficulties in eye-to-eye gaze. In the communication criteria, we have speech delay. That's, you know, usually the one that we look at. But with the new criteria, I believe that it's going to mainstream the disorder and make it more like these are the symptom clusters that we actually are seeing in large numbers, and really redefine it for the betterment of the actual population.
If you could sort of give us a bottom line on how the new diagnostic criteria in the DSM-5, how will that change how you do your job as a psychiatrist?
It will really define things. So it's asking us to really take a look at if there is a problem with the person's social and emotional reciprocity, which is a give and take of, you know, emotion and feelings, a real deficiency in nonverbal communicative behaviors, as well as a real deficiency in developing and maintaining relationships. And on top of that, we're kind of redefining and being more strict on the criteria of restricted repetitive patterns of behavior and interests or activities. So this is like obsessing over a certain topic or having sensory overload when things like noises get too loud. So those are patterns of behavior that we're honing in on that we're seeing in every case of autism.
Dr. Ghosh, it seems like what you just described, that's not something that you can judge in, like, you know, a 30-minute appointment. So you're really relying on parents, aren't you, or caregivers, to sort of paint you a picture of what it's like for them at home. Is that how it works generally?
Yes. So we observe the child for, you know, a fair amount of time in a couple of sessions, but we definitely have to get the defining features from the parents. Like, the speech delay has to occur before age 3. So, you know, we have to get that history. And if that history is not present, then yes, they do not meet criteria. But that's unfortunate at times if the history is inaccurate and the kid still needs services and we can't define it. So that's frustrating as a provider at times.
What are you seeing in your office? Do you see parents coming in knowing a lot about autism and autism spectrum disorders already? Or what usually happens on that first visit?
Well, it's varied, but most likely people have heard of the autism diagnosis and the Asperger's diagnosis, which that's a big change for the DSM-5. They're actually doing away with Asperger's, Rett's, and Child Disintegrative Disorder. And, you know, if you don't meet the criteria for autism, you meet the criteria for social communication disorder. So they're really redefining that part of it. But when someone comes into my office, you know, a mother is fairly anxious. Autism is the type of diagnosis that isn't to be taken lightly. It's a concrete neurodevelopmental disorder that shows very little in terms of response to symptomatology. We definitely target symptoms and make those symptoms better, but there's not a whole lot of general improvement in the social and communication parts of things. And it's a fixed diagnosis. So there's a lot of grief and loss involved in that. So we are very careful at making it a two initial diagnostic process with another licensed psychological counselor, Shane Chappell, in my office, as well as myself. We do a double process and make sure that we really hone in on the particular nuances of the disorder.
Okay.
And so with that, what I'm seeing is that the rates are right. The rates are correct, that we're seeing a huge amount of autism. I get a fair amount of, you know, new cases of autism coming into my clinic every day.
Dr. Shubhu Ghosh, thank you so much for speaking with us on Kids These Days.
Thank you so much.
The fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or the DSM-5, will be released in May 2013. We'll connect you to these new criteria and to Dr. Ghosh's practice at kidsthesedays.org. This is Kids These Days, and today our conversation is about autism spectrum disorders. I'm Shannon Sheehy, and I'm joined today by Teresa Hurst and Chris Green for that discussion. I'd like to invite you ladies to respond to that piece that Sarah prepared for us with Dr. Ghosh. He says he's seeing in his own practice this increase in numbers, and he explained that a little bit, and I'm wondering if you guys have a response.
I think the media has, including a lot of TV movies, but also news programs, there's been a lot of media coverage on autism. And with that, some understanding of what does this look like for an individual, what problems that they have. And so I think that that increased awareness is helpful for parents in terms of identifying that in their child and understanding that there's help for that mm-hmm. out in the community.
Mm-hmm. And Chris. I believe that at the state of Alaska, we are absolutely committed to supporting that accurate diagnoses are going on, and we're supporting the programs and systems that help absolutely define this correctly, including standardized testing tools that should be used in a comprehensive multidisciplinary assessment system. Those tools are available and are used by infant learning program providers, public health nurses. They are being used as part of a referral process. All of these things building upon accuracy, that we are getting kids what they need and an accurate diagnosis for them.
Now, Chris Green, you stress accuracy. So is it the case then that there are inaccurate diagnoses of autism? Is that something that is happening, or autism spectrum disorders? Is that happening with some prevalence that you see, that you feel like, is that where the passion is coming from for that? Teresa Hurst, it looks like you wanted to answer.
You know, I think that there are some overlapping symptoms between individuals with autism and, say, individuals with social anxieties, individuals with global developmental conditions. And so because of those overlapping symptoms, it's important for someone that has experience in diagnosing autism to be the individual assessing that particular child, so that we do identify these children accurately, because the differences that if you know, what is right for a child with autism isn't necessarily the right thing for somebody that would, say, have social phobias. And so that's the treatment is to identify those children correctly means getting them into the correct treatment, which is why that is so important in terms of that accuracy.
Because if it's something like a social phobia, it would be totally different from treatment for autism.
And so, as the Autism and Parent Services Manager working for the state of Alaska, I'm getting daily calls about, you know, these numbers are huge and they're alarming. Are they real? Is this really what's going on? And part of, in response to Teresa's, you know, there's a lot in the news about it right now, and people are concerned that it's being overdiagnosed. And my role is to reassure the public that we are doing our using a system of evidence-based practice that is accurately diagnosing these children. And yes, there is a large number of children who need support, assistance, and intervention services.
Do you think there is an overdiagnosis of autism, given, I mean, you mentioned that it's in the media, people are reading about it, they're learning about it, you know, is it so much on people's minds that it's the first thing people go to when they think that there's something wrong?
I can speak from the neurodevelopmental outreach and autism screening clinics that I run, that we've had over 400 referrals to this clinic throughout the state of Alaska over the last 3 years. The vast, vast majority of the referrals come in as a rule out of autism or other autism spectrum disorder, the vast majority of them. And in reality, only about 35% of those children are coming and referred into Anchorage then for a full diagnostic workup through the Autism Diagnostic Center at Providence.
So your observation then, if I can paraphrase, you know, that there are people that are concerned, kids are coming in, but then the percentage of those kids who really need a full-blown diagnostic assessment are about 35% of those kids.
Correct.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So tell us more about the rural clinics and these neurodevelopmental screening clinics that happen across the state. Mm-hmm. And I want to know where those are happening, what happens at them, and what you guys are looking for when you do the screenings.
Sure. I started in 2008 in expanding the program from just Juneau and Fairbanks outreach when we were hearing and realizing that that there is a concern in this community. Children with autism and autism-like symptoms are often challenged with sensory issues, and flying and traveling and being out and in different spaces agitate those symptoms. Mm-hmm. And so we at the state decided that it would be better to go out into the rural communities. And because there's only one pediatric neurodevelopmental specialist in the state of Alaska who is being burdened with huge numbers, that we were going to go out and try reducing that referral so that those who truly needed to come in were getting in. In addition, it's very costly in time and resource. Mm-hmm. Families come in for a week mm-hmm. and have a week of appointments for a full diagnostic workup. And that's very expensive yeah. to do time-wise, et cetera, off the job and the actual medical costs associated. So our goals were to reduce the cost associated with that, as well as begin to see or match up early and intensive identification screening so that we are identifying children younger and younger. And we felt that the best way to do that was to go out into the rural hub and partner with public health nursing, infant learning program, Head Start offices, the actual Native Health Corporations and the IHS services in the rural communities as medical homes, partner with them, identify these kids, come in, do these screenings and identification appointments, mm-hmm. and then make recommendations to them so that if the child does not need to come into Anchorage, let's get them into services or whatever they need. But those who do need to come in, get them in as quickly as possible.
Plus, I imagine with those partnerships, the medical professionals who are working there are also learning about how to make these diagnoses, what to be on the lookout for, and they might even be picking up some kids who would otherwise not be coming in.
I have the privilege of working with Teresa, who's a wonderful educator, and in most communities we've gone out and done presentations, and probably, I don't have the number exactly, but it's right around 250 people in communities have been trained and heard us speak on these issues. We go to Barrow, Bethel, Kotzebue, Nome, Dillingham, Kodiak, Ketchikan, Juneau, and Valdez. So we make 10 stops in addition to Fairbanks and Juneau.
Well, Teresa Hurst, tell us about, you know, what your role is. You two work together. You work with Chris Green on this. So you're the person in the field, right, who's doing the screening and talking with the folks. And, you know, what is it that you're doing when you're out there?
So I'm out there. I'm doing assessments to identify, those individuals that have a high likelihood or probability of having autism that do need that comprehensive assessment piece like Chris was talking about, but also to identify children that are having other neurodevelopmental concerns, looking at how to match them best with resources either here or in their community, or what is available resource-wise outside of their community that I can connect them to. And it's been a blessing to work with those families who never come in with complaints, but only with what can I do for my child? It's a very humbling experience, to tell you the truth, when that's what you hear over and over, what can I do for my child? And a lot of what I do is also educate the family on what is going on, why are you seeing the difference in this child, what's causing that, what can you do for that, whether it's autism or not.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, typically, and this is kind of asking you to be general about it, but, you know, the families that come to you and they have a concern about their kid, whether it's autism that ultimately is a diagnosis or not, you know, are parents typically, do they have the gut feeling on it? Do they typically know when their kid isn't neurodevelopmentally typical?
I think there's a mix of where a family is in processing the differences that they're noticing in their child. Obviously, it's for any family or any parent, it's a very devastating thing to notice that your child's struggling in any way, shape, or form. We don't wish that for any of our children. And so there are some families where they're not as ready in terms of they may see the differences and they may discuss them, but they may not quite accept that these differences are part of something else. So that can be a little bit challenging, but it's always helpful to start giving that family information about what you feel is going on with their child and just accepting where they're at and keeping that door open for them. And then there are definitely families that have come in. They have been rightfully identified within their community and have started into some resources and are ready to understand their child a little bit better. They know there's some differences here, and they just want to understand what's going on.
Well, this is Kids These Days. This program is heard on 7 Alaska stations in 6 local communities. Kids These Days is a production of the Content Producers Guild, an Alaska nonprofit that supports the efforts of independent media makers. This program is produced and distributed thanks to the partnership of KSKA-FM Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. Still to come today, we'll discover the power of animals and what they can do to help with communicating and connecting with people on the autism spectrum. That and more coming up after a quick break. Next time on Kids These Days, we take a look at cultural education reform and place-based education. We report on how educators across the state are incorporating Alaska Native traditions and language in classrooms and curriculum. Our in-studio guests talk about the philosophy behind the movement and explain its origins. And we hear from a school choice supporter who is critical of the whole idea. Join us for that and more next time. We're back. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and this is Kids These Days. Chris Green and Teresa Hurst are with me today to talk about autism spectrum disorders and the resources we have out there for families in need all across the state. We'll get back to that conversation right after this. Autism spectrum disorder can be complex, even to the psychologists who study it, but it's not so complicated to one group of kindergartners in Southeast Alaska. Tara Bicknell takes us into a classroom in Haines, where the kids are helping the adults there learn about autism.
The students in Haines' only kindergarten class are learning what most other kids across the country learn in their first year of school: the days of the week, coins, how to share. But there's one unique lesson they're getting from one of their own classmates and his mom, Victoria.
Remember when I talked to you about Alex at the beginning of the school year?
Yeah.
What he has? It's about that he has autism.
Yeah.
And do you remember what he's allergic to?
Strawberries.
Strawberries.
Well, he doesn't talk like us or anything like that. And he's really different from us. And he's a good friend.
Cadessa is describing her schoolmate, Alex Moore. Alex is one of the 16 kids in the class, and he's autistic.
Time for going, yeah.
Like his classmates, Alex starts the school day hurriedly checking each of the toy boxes around the room before finding his assigned spot in front of kindergarten teacher Mrs. Dagan. But some of his characteristics, she says, are not like the other students.
His receptive language is there. The problem is he doesn't speak back very much, and when he does speak back, it's going to be one word.
Mrs. Sandy June Dagan has been teaching for 38 years. She says when Alex joined the class this year, the students and parents were curious about how Alex would fit in and wondered how they should act around him.
And so I asked Victoria, and I said, would you tell the parents and the children? So that's when she came in, and told us what to expect.
Victoria says her son used to use words until he was about a year and a half old. That's when things changed, fast, and she began looking for answers. She scoured local and state resources, did her own research, and she brought Alex to an annual screening put on by the school.
In Alex's situation, it was a sensory issue, but we had to get him to a psychiatrist to diagnose him, the autism.
Victoria says Alex's disorder has meant a lot of changes in their family's life. But there have been changes in the classroom, too. The Haynes School has a separate room equipped with a tire swing for children like Alex to go and spend some of their extra energy. Alex has also had a one-on-one adult aide since he was 4.
We could not replace what we have here. I mean, part of it, too, has been I've advocated for Alex. I've helped develop by not hiding his autism, you know, and accepting. I think that's the biggest part of it, is having to accept really early that he was autistic and that it was like, okay, I need to get him help. How do I do that? You know, reach out into the community and get answers.
And we've seen over the 7 or so months that he's been in kindergarten with us this year, we've seen him come out more and use one word phrases more.
He is really talking a lot.
He's growing up.
All of you have helped him with his communicating.
Us?
A lot, yes.
How we do that?
You guys include him and you do things with him.
And everybody knows how to, you know, how to say hi to Alex. You high-five him with your knuckles. Alex will be in the grocery store, and one of our children will then repeat to their little sibling, this is how you say hi to Alex. And so the town now knows how to say hi to Alex, and because the children are the educators. It's wonderful. So Victoria did a magical kind of thing for the whole town.
I feel empowering the children, you know, to learn how to engage with him by, you know, doing high five and, you know, and it makes them feel good. And they feel a part of him.
He already has this support net under him, his class, that he'll go on through school with. And they understand him.
Me and Alex kind of play together in the playroom where he plays. We play games, like good games, but not bad games. He's so cool and funny.
That's what I love about this community, you know, that it took one parent wanting to know about Alex to get this ball rolling with us to really empower the children and their parents.
Well, I just wanted to thank all of you. You guys have been just great friends and great classmates to Alex. And he just loves being with all of you.
Yeah. It's a joy to have him in here.
Thank you.
In Haynes, I'm Tara Bicknell.
You can share your stories or comment on this show by going to Kids These Days Facebook page or by writing directly on our website. That's kidsthesedays.org. I'm Shannon Sheehy, and Chris Green and Teresa Hurst are with me in the studio today, and we're talking about autism spectrum disorders. And one of the things that I love so much about that piece that Tara Bicknell produced from Haynes was just the community and family and wonderful support net that it seems like that child Alex has there. And I think it's a great time to ask the two of you about support and community resources that people can access statewide for autism spectrum disorder.
Sure. As part of the effort from the Gov's Council ad hoc committee on autism, there was a comprehensive and very focused effort in providing resources to families and support statewide and to build those programs around that. So in addition to training and working with professionals in the field who understand the needs of these children and then those professionals working individually with families, parents can also access services through the Autism Society of Alaska with a marvelous, marvelous leader, Heidi Haas, who won the National Volunteer of the Year Award. She's an incredible, dynamic woman, mother of a child with autism. That service is available, and they do a lot of work statewide in getting activities going, specifically during Autism Awareness Month, but is on board with training opportunities, webinars, those sorts of things, and is in the middle of of lots of the activities supporting families. In addition, the Special Education Service Agency was funded a significant grant to develop the Alaska Autism Resource Center, which has a huge library of books, lending library of not just books and videos and DVDs, but they also do a great deal of work in one-on-one with families and providing support. Anchorage School District runs support groups twice a month for families with autism. And then, of course, and last but not least, is the Stone Soup Group, mm-hmm. which is a parent-driven, parent-led organization that provides services and navigation to families who are new to special needs children and or transition new issues for their children. And as a parent-led organization and parent-hired, they're the Been There, Done That Club. And they have 800 numbers and are incredibly supportive for families.
And thank you for that list. We will also link directly from our website at kidsthesedays.org from where the show will be posted to all of those resources and then more that we're able to drum up as well. So thank you for that, Chris.
Sure.
You know, I'm wondering, Teresa, you're a nurse, so you have mentioned that you're in the room with families. It seems like an emotional, as Chris just mentioned, you know, they're... It can be an emotional time. It can be a difficult time for a family when they learn that their child is on the autism spectrum. And I'm wondering, you know, from your perspective of being there firsthand sometimes, what is a good way that a friend or, you know, a family member who's not an immediate family member could support a family with a child who is on the autism spectrum?
I think just listening. Often these families can get fairly isolated, and having a child that often needs so much of their time and supervision, having someone that just can be there to listen to what it's like, it's often helpful to link these families to other families that have children and in order to give them some hope, you can get through this. In terms of, you know, just having a friend that's there that says, you know, just tell me what it's like. Tell me what I can do. It's just like any other friendship that you have with another parent is just be there in terms of saying, what is it can I do for you? The state also offers some support in terms of resources such as respite care, mm-hmm. habilitation mm-hmm. care, in cases where families have children that, you know, it's really difficult to take some of these guys because it's very distressing for the child into public places. So it becomes something totally different for these parents to have to take their child to, say, a grocery store. Sometimes it's because the child gets so distressed. And so having supports like respite care are very important for these families. And our state has provided funding for that, which is very important. It's that story about Haines was amazing. And I think that's the richness of some of the rural communities that I go into, is that they often are so accepting and don't always see the difference. This is just one of us. And but often are very interested in learning about what can we do to support the child? What can we do to support the family? And so that's the, I think, the strength of some of these rural communities, is they do build, you know, that support around families and children that need that support.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's perhaps a little trite to say, but it takes a village to raise a child. Mm-hmm. In some of these situations, families become incredibly isolated, and the more open communities are, these are children with autism are beautiful children, and they don't have a scarlet A on their forehead that identifies them as autism. They are exhibiting communication and often extreme behaviors, and families are labeled as bad parents, and that's not the case at all. And so families get isolated and lose friendships and become anxious, mm-hmm. and it snowballs.
Well, I'd like to also mention that from kidsthesedays.org, we're going to link you to a list at babbel.com, and it's a list of 30 autism blogs. So they've selected 30 of what they feel are the best, and they come from a variety of perspectives, from the perspective of parents, from the perspective of a young adult living with Asperger's syndrome. They kind of run the gamut, and that's another place where, you know, reading about someone else's experiences, if you're having something similar, can feel really supportive as well. And we, you know, we're talking about stresses or isolation. Chris Green, you mentioned the isolation of families. I wanted to mention a couple of other things that we discovered as we were looking into the issue and the topic of autism. But we found that mothers of children with autism, on average, make less money than mothers with children who are not on the autism spectrum, which I thought was interesting. We'll link you to that study from our website. And also that there are real significant costs that go along with having a child who is on the autism spectrum. And this is from the state website, from our state of Alaska website about autism. But the average direct costs for autism-related medical and behavioral treatments reach about $30,000 per year per child. And then the Autism Society estimates that the lifetime cost of caring for a child with autism ranges from $3.5 million to $5 million. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, you said, Teresa, that there is some funding for respite care and so on and so forth. But do many families find themselves in a real financial pinch to get the services they need for their kids? And you know, how is it that they pay for that? That's a lot of money, $30,000 a year.
It is a lot of money. Yes, it's costing the United States at over $140 billion. That's what the estimate is.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's a huge, huge, huge concern. Families are indeed being pinched financially, and they are desperate to find the services to meet their needs. I think in Alaska, we are very creative, and we use a lot of duct tape to pull our programs together. And we are creative and think outside the box because we have to. You can drive to many places in the continental United States, but in Alaska, you can only get there by snow machine, etc. So when we start thinking outside of the box, we start doing things like workforce development, where we are creating a cohort of new students who will be trainees, but begin to do some of these intensive early intervention services. But as students, they are getting their hours, and the child is benefiting. So those are some.
So would these be education students or something like that, or social work students? Or?
These are mastered prepared students who are going through a cohort through the Center for Human Development,
okay.
And it's called ABA, or Applied Behavior Analysis. Now these are services. These are, we had one ABA certified person in the state when I started. We now have cohorts that are graduating, and these are there as students needing to practice what they are learning.
Mm-hmm.
So we begin to do that when families cannot provide the services directly and they're wanting them.
Interesting.
I think we can look at how we best spend our dollars by looking at our research within autism and understanding that the earlier we can provide that intensive services, the less money, the more functional that individual is going to be, the less problems or I don't want to say problems, but
issues.
Conflicts that the family will have, and the more able the individual is to stay within their community, within their home, I think cost what used to happen for individuals with autism is they were often institutionalized, which is such a shame when you meet these individuals and how interesting and unique and they see and perceive their world. And now with early intervention, a lot of these kids are very functional, but it's a matter of getting that intensive service as early as possible. If we can do that, we really reduce a lot of the cost and problems for the individual, for the family, for the community, for the United States. But it's one of those things that when we look at the services these children need, they need 25 hours a week as best practice of direct services. That includes speech and language. That includes things like occupational therapy. Chris mentioned the applied behavioral analysis to work on the
back and forth interaction that needs to happen. It's also that support that the family needs in terms of education, you know, so that is a year-round program is also best practice. And again, what we know research-wise, what's happening in our communities, they're not quite meeting, but that's the goal of the Governor's Council, the Autism Ad Hoc, is really to expand where we are now so that we can meet that, because it makes so much sense. You know, we have so much evidence that's where we need to move towards. But we have issues here in our state, one being that, like Chris said, you get on a plane or you get on your snowmobile to get to your school, to get to wherever you need to go. And so these families that are out in rural communities, getting these specialists out to them is very important in terms of how, you know, allowing that family to function, that child to function as well as they can.
And giving them the best opportunities.
And there are so many new horizons in telemedicine and telehealth that they're beginning some intensive behavioral intervention services through telehealth, as well as through the Native Health Corporations. They are actually training up community health aides that are providing behavioral intervention services. Mm-hmm. So we're getting creative.
Mm-hmm.
Not soon or fast enough, but we are working towards it.
Well, speaking of services, direct services, here's this. The bond between a child and his dog are well documented in literature and movies. Now, more and more, people are realizing how working with animals can benefit people with autism. Sometimes an animal can provide a kind of support that other people can't. Kids These Days contributor Jessica Cochran met some people working with children and dogs and learned about the benefits for both humans and canines.
In a training room at Anchorage Animal Control Center, 10-year-old Kyle Knutson is working with a dog named Sasha. He's known her since she was 14 weeks old, and they get along pretty well.
She's really fun to play with because she licks me all the time.
Are you like getting licked?
Yes.
Cool. And have you worked with Sasha before?
Yes, many times.
Kyle is part of a training class run by Alaska Assistance Dogs in partnership with the Stone Soup Group. It's offered as a support to families with children who have autism. Kyle's mother, Dale, signed up as soon as she heard about it.
Kyle did not interact socially with a lot of kids prior to this. This gives him a good place to interact with other kids, try out different social activities. He talks more to other kids, and he's learning a little bit of responsibility and listening.
And do you see this carry over into other parts of his life? Or?
Definitely. It definitely carries across the boards, and I also see a change at home because he tries to do the same techniques with our dogs at home.
Watching Kyle with the dogs, he's outgoing and exuberant. You'd never guess he didn't used to be social. Instructor Carolyn Stone says that's typical. She teaches this class, where about half the kids have autism, the same way she'd teach any other class.
Once or twice the dogs have been late, and so we have the kids without the dogs, and it's a totally different classroom. But with the dogs here, there's a little bit of magic, I guess you could say, in that the dogs respond to the kids.
Carol Shea, co-founder of Alaska Assistance Dogs, says the kids are excellent dog trainers. The animals they are working with today are all younger than 2 years old and will be placed as assistance dogs when they complete training. But the kids are getting a lot out of it as well. Shea also works with a group of older special needs teens in the Valley.
Again, it's a young adult building leadership skills and social skills and self-esteem and being able to take direction and focus for job skills. And so these young people, they wouldn't even speak much. Very shy, you know, this type of thing, and then eyes down. You can't get a dog to do a command if you go, you know, eyes down and you're kind of quiet, you say sit. You know, so we teach shoulders back, head up, and a command voice. And boy, will they use that in life.
Before Peg Walsh Burnert can worry about future careers or socializing for her son Leo, she has to be able to keep him safe. At age 3, he would run away and hide, not answering as his family called and searched for him. Walsh Bernert found an organization called Four Paws for Ability, which trains autism assistance dogs, including training them to track their kids if they go missing. Within 6 months, her family had raised $12,000 and gotten their dog Halo, a golden retriever who, Walsh Bernert says, gave her her life back. In addition to tracking Leo, Halo is trained to be tethered to him.
And what that is that mom or handler always has the leash, but the kid is tethered to the dog with a tether strap. And that way your hands are free for the first time, and for us, 4 years. They were free. I could stop and talk to someone. I could stop and write a check. Things like going to the store for milk. If I needed milk, I would not. If I had to take Leo into the store, we wouldn't just not have milk. After Halo, it was, absolutely no problem. So little things like that should change for us, which add up to being a really big thing.
Autism assistance dogs are also trained to disrupt pattern behaviors, like spinning in circles. And they have some sort of intuition about when kids are getting anxious. Walsh Bernert tells the story of watching Halo help another little girl in her son's class at school.
And there's a little girl in there who couldn't find the pink crayon. It wasn't in the thing. Well, it was a disaster for her. And she started, you could see her escalate. You could see her starting to stress, starting to lose it. And Halo picked up on that, walked over there to this little girl and put her head in her lap. And the little girl first was super surprised. She kind of had this look, and I thought, oh, boy. And then she smiled, and she started petting Halo, and the crisis was over. You could just see the tension melt out of her.
The dogs are trained to lie with their kids and just to be a calming presence. Halo goes to school with Leo every day. When Leo's upset, a few minutes with her calms him down and lets him get back to work. He doesn't seek that same support from people.
Because people want something back, and dogs don't. Kids with autism, they're always being demanded upon. Look at me. Look at me, look at me. Use your words. Yes or no. First this, then that. I mean, there's just poor kids. They're just hammered. A dog doesn't do that to them. The dog just is there.
Walsh Bernert was so impressed by how Halo helped her family that she trained in training assistance dogs. She now heads Four Paws for Abilities Anchorage branch, and she's working with 5 dogs who will be trained to assist people with different needs for hearing loss, seizures, or autism. Four Paws requires families to reach a fundraising goal. All the contributions go to Four Paws and are tax deductible. Peg Walsh Bernert cautions that not every dog can or should be an assistance dog in public. It requires a lot of training to make sure the dog will always do what they need to do in every situation. But as people have known for hundreds of years, and the students, parents, and teachers at service dog training keep rediscovering, time with a well-trained animal can be therapeutic. I'm Jessica Cochran.
This is Kids These Days. Chris Green and Teresa Hurst are here today, and we're talking about autism and autism spectrum disorders. I'm Shanna Shee. Let us know what you think by commenting at kidsthesedays.org. So before we run out of time to have this conversation today, I think it's very important for you both to help us understand a little bit about what we know about the causes of autism. You know, I've stated that recently there's been new prevalence rates that have come out that 1 in 88 kids is being diagnosed now on the autism spectrum. Another thing that we found as we were researching here at Kids These Days is that we found that a recent report published in Pediatrics says that if you're obese during pregnancy, you have a 1 in 53 chance of your child having autism or being on the autism spectrum. That's versus 1 in 88 if you're not obese. So there's another piece of information. You know, on the state website for autism, it's the graphics there are a puzzle, right? And all these different pieces that go into this puzzle seems yet another piece to the puzzle. But what do we know about autism and why autism happens?
I think the easiest answer is to say we don't know. The theories are that there seems to be some genetic link, but there hasn't been one gene that's been identified as causing autism, and yet we know that children that have genetic disorders such as Fragile X have a higher probability of having autistic-like characteristics that go along with that syndrome. There's also a theory that along with the genetics, that we also have an environmental factor that are
it's kind of the frontier of epigenetics, which is to say that you may have a predisposition to having a genetic disorder, but that something's turning genes on and off. And we have this theory because if we look at identical twins, not both of them always have autism. So if it was purely genetic alone, that would not be the case. There's also some thought that like a third of children with autism have some gastrointestinal differences, that there's probably a third of children with autism have a regression in their skills, so they may develop fairly normal up until about 18 to 24 months of age, and then regress in their communication and social skills. So we believe that there's probably subtypes of what we call the autism spectrum. There may be different causes that present similar symptoms. So these individuals that we are that are on the autism spectrum, there may be different causes for different types of autism, if you will.
In some way, that describes at least why the answer for what's causing it is so elusive.
That's definitely one of the answers, is that there's lots of theories, but we haven't found the cause, one cause. And I, when you look at the literature, I seem to agree with the theory that there's probably more than one cause mm-hmm. for autism spectrum disorder out there.
Well, Chris Green, you have the last word today.
The Combating Autism Act that was initiated by the federal government in 2005-06 really put a lot of money into the research side of it. So the Health Services, HRSA, Health Services Resource Administration, as well as the CDC, Center for Disease Control, is spending an enormous amount of money in trying to come up with and identify those. The Women in Obesity study, great information, but I think there are some unanswered questions with that. And what we know it is not is initiated by immunizations, that immunizations are indeed safe and children should be immunized and vaccinated.
And I should mention on the state website, which we'll link to from Kids These Days, it says to find out about current and credible autism research, you can visit the CDC, and we'll link to the state's website and to the CDC, but that was with respect to whether or not autism is caused by immunizations. We'll link to some Mayo Clinic information on that as well that we found. Well, thanks so much to both of you for your time this hour. Chris Green is the Autism and Prevention Services Manager for the Alaska State Division of Public Health. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Teresa Hurst is an advanced pediatric nurse practitioner, and she works with the Children's Hospital at Providence and does statewide screening. Thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
We'll link you to the work our guests do, as well as all of the resources, plus some more that we've mentioned today throughout the show. That's all easy to find at kidsthesedays.org. Also there, some information about a topic we didn't have time to get to today, and that was aging with autism and the transition between childhood and adulthood and other transitions that happen after you're an adult. We've got a new piece from our regular blogger, Erin Kirkland. She's contributed a personal piece for us about helping autistic children transition from their younger years into adulthood, and you can check that out online. That's kidsthesedays.org. This program had help today from Tara Bicknell in Haynes. Jessica Cochran is our regular contributor. Sarah Gonzalez is our producer, web content editor, and business manager. I'm Shanna Sheehy. Thanks for spending time with me today, and I'll see you next time.
Kids These Days is an independent production of the Content Producers Guild. The opinions shared on the program are those of the host, guest, and contributors and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KTD producers, partners, or funders. Major funding for Kids These Days comes from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. The program is made in partnership with KSKA-FM in Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. Find out more about Kids These Days anytime at kidstheseDays.org.